And welcome to the Paul Hastings webinar titled The Top 5 Private Equity Practices Grabbing SCE Attention. As a reminder, this call will be recorded and all lines will be on a listen-only mode. We will provide a CLE verification code towards the end of the call as well as instructions for submitting questions. This program is also being presented live in New York. I would now like to turn the call over to the office chair of Paul Hastings New York office, Barry Brooks, so we now may begin. Barry, please go ahead.
This is Nick Morgan, partner in the Los Angeles office of Paul Hastings. Just a quick note to the folks who came out live here in New York. As the operator indicated, we are webcasting this, so a couple of logistical matters. If you could turn off your phones, that'd be helpful. Questions, there are note cards on your chairs for the live participants. So if you have questions, just write them on the note cards and we'll collect them and bring them up for us to answer later. Thank you for coming, of course. We don't, in Los Angeles office, we actually have signs that say when to applaud in the live audience. We don't have those here, so you're on your own there. But now I'd like to turn it over to our managing partner here in New York, Barry. Thank you.
People in New York know when to applaud. We don't need the lights. Anyway, I wanted to thank all of you for coming. All of those of you who are listening online and those who are here in person, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm Barry Brooks, the chair of the New York office, just talking about the fact that I'm a Los Angeles transplant, so I can speak with authority about lights and cameras and action. So thank you very much for coming. The genesis of this event today is the increasing scrutiny, activity, enforcement activity, inquiries that our clients are receiving from the SEC these days, and there's a huge flurry. I can tell you in my own practice, we're seeing a lot of it. And in response to that, we're getting a lot of questions from clients, and we thought it was appropriate to take a little time to assemble a very expert panel to answer some of those questions and talk about what the SEC is focusing on these days. So hopefully this is, and I think it will be, very relevant and pertinent to what's going on in your world at the moment. As I said, we're fortunate to have a great panel here. Just going to introduce Monique Botkin, who's the Associate General Counsel for the Investment Advisor Association in Washington. She joined the IAA in February 2004 and previously had been the Financial Services Groups of Dechert in Orange County, California, and Alston and Byrd in Washington, D.C. She represented, as a private practitioner, investment advisors, registered investment companies, private funds, and broker-dealers in corporate securities and investment management matters. And Monique served as an attorney in the SEC's Division of Investment Management Disclosure Review from 2013-2014. And I'll hand it over to the panel.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here today and walk us through some really important topics that private equity fund advisors are facing today. I want to introduce our panelists first. To my left is Troy Paredes. He's the founder of Paredes Strategies, and from 2008 to 2013, he was a commissioner of the SEC, having been appointed by President George W. Bush. At the SEC, Troy was a strong advocate for small business and the Jobs Act, for solving the information overload problem of securities law disclosure, and for rigorous cost-benefit analysis. He also consistently expressed concerns about the overregulation and overreach of the Dodd-Frank Act. Since leaving the SEC, he has been an active in his consulting practice. He advises on financial regulation, corporate governance, compliance, and governmental and regulatory affairs. He also serves as an expert and an advisor in regulatory enforcement investigations and actions, and in private litigation involving securities law and corporate law. And he has also been an independent compliance consultant and monitor. Before becoming an SEC commissioner, Mr. Paredes was a professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis and a professor of business at Washington University's Olin Business School. Currently, he is a distinguished scholar in residence at NYU School of Law and a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School. Next to Troy is Nick Morgan. Nick is a partner in the investigations and white-collar defense practice at Paul Hastings and based in the LA office, as he said. He joined Paul Hastings from Zaccaro Morgan, a boutique firm he co-founded, which focused on high-stakes, complex civil litigation, SEC and other government investigations, and defense, white-collar criminal defense, and independent internal investigations. Earlier in his career, he was a longtime partner at another international law firm where he served as West Coast Chair of the Securities Enforcement Practice, Los Angeles Hiring Partner, and he managed a myriad of securities investigations and related arbitrations and litigation. Nick also previously served as a senior trial counsel in the SEC's Division of Enforcement. During his time there, he served as lead counsel on a wide variety of litigated matters, including insider trading, investment advisor fraud, revenue recognition fraud, broker-dealer fraud, mutual fund market timing, and market manipulation. He also served as a special assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of California. We're also fortunate to have Stefano Branca. He's a principal in charge of Marcum, California's region of the firm's advisory services division. He's based in the firm's Los Angeles office and a member of its forensics practice group. He served as an expert witness in several financial reporting matters under investigation by the Department of Justice, the U.S. General Accounting Office, and the Federal Trade Commission. He's also a certified fraud examiner and a certified internal control auditor, as well as a forensic certified public accountant. Prior to joining Marcum, Stefano held managing director positions with Big Four and other national accounting firms where he provided litigation support and consulting services to clients. And last but not least, Tram Nguyen is a partner in the investment management practice of Paul Hastings and based here in the firm's New York office. She focuses her practice on hedge funds and private equity funds, advising clients on all aspects of fund formation, fund structuring, and capital raising. She also advises U.S. and non-U.S. financial institutions and advisors on regulatory requirements in the U.S., including registration and reporting requirements. Prior to joining Paul Hastings, Tram was a partner at another U.S. law firm and branch chief of the private funds branch at the SEC's Division of Investment Management in D.C. She worked there on developing rules for hedge funds and private equity fund advisors under the Dodd-Frank Act and the Jobs Act. So now I will turn it over to Nick, who will lead us off on the next topic.
Sure. So before we jump into the top five practices, I wanted to give a little bit of context for why we're seeing so many questions coming up in the exam context, enforcement actions being brought. And the simplest driver, the simplest explanation is Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank, in particular, had two provisions, one that are sort of manifesting themselves now. One was the requirement that investment advisors register. That just put an enormous, larger number of firms in the exam process. And so it took quite a while for the SEC to conduct all of its presence exams, but there's a much larger target for them to shoot at with that registration requirement. The other, which is reflected on the slide in front of you, the other provision of Dodd-Frank that's had a big effect not just in the investment advisor space but across the board in SEC regulatory matters is the Dodd-Frank whistleblower bounty program. So the bounty program, as the SEC is fond of pointing out as often as possible, has paid out a large number of bounties to a large number of people. Here you can see depicted on this graph the top 10 awards. When you start handing out $30 million, $22 million, or even some of the smaller ones, $2, $3, $1 million, that gets people's attention. It, as designed, it incentivizes people to come forth with information. So if you combine the Dodd-Frank registration provisions with the whistleblower provisions, it goes a long way to explaining why we're seeing now many of the questions that are coming up. And if you could advance it to the next slide. Here we see tips by state. 10,500 tips from 2011 to 2015 across the country, and in fact, not depicted on this slide, across the globe. This is getting people's attention. People are responding to the incentives that Dodd-Frank has provided. So that's a little bit of context. More specifically, and you can go ahead and once OC started doing its examinations and started sort of publicly speaking about the issues that it was seeing, that gave the enforcement division a target to shoot at. So back in May of 2014, the then director of OC said over 50% of exam and private equity fund advisors have compliance issues and identified a few. That obviously, that 50% number got people's attention. And as one might expect, the OC folks work hand in hand with the enforcement folks. That 50% number got the attention of the enforcement people. And then earlier this year. We probably could have sampled any number of speeches given by senior SEC folks and gotten a similar sentiment to what Andrew Ceresni indicated in May of this year. The enforcement division's focus on private equity has expanded significantly over the past 3 years. So you can see Dodd-Frank requires registration. OC goes out and does a whole bunch of exams and finds things to for the enforcement division to look at. And now we're seeing those enforcement cases find their way through the pipeline and give rise to a large number of cases, enforcement cases, but also examination questions and just issues arising. So as Barry indicated at the beginning, what we want to do is hit pause for a minute, look at some of the more significant enforcement actions that have been brought in the last year, year and a half in the PE space, sort of deconstruct them, look at what the issue is, and then offer sort of lessons learned or at least identify the issues that the SEC is focused on in the form of our top five issues. So the top five issues are derived from, actually, put your back up one slide, please, thanks, derived from these cases listed on the slide. And each one, we're not going to go into every detail of each of these cases. Instead, we've sort of looked at the essence of the case or the thing that can be applied most broadly from each one of these cases, and we'll sort of be taking turns. And so each one of these cases corresponds to an issue, and now you can go to the next slide. And these are the five issues that we'll be addressing today, transaction fee offsets, accelerated monitoring fees, broken deal expenses, transaction-based compensation, and allocating registration and compliance expenses, which came up in each one of the cases.
Great.
If I can jump in just real quick before we get into those particulars, just to build on what Nick said. There's two other, I think, background points, and I think were implicit in what was said, but that are worth teasing out. One is that a handful of years ago, the SEC also developed so-called specialized units in the enforcement division. One of those specialized units focuses on investment management, and that's going to include investment advisors. So you have a group within the enforcement division which is focused on this space. So that's one additional point. The other is a somewhat bigger picture point about how some folks at the SEC are viewing private equity. And one, I think, could extend this beyond private equity to other private funds, but I'm just going to read quickly a quote from a speech that Andrew Ceresni, who's the director of the Division of Enforcement, gave in May of this year. And this is a quote from Andrew. He says, "Now, why is the SEC spending its limited resources on the private equity industry given the sophistication of most investors?" A question I would probably note a lot of people have asked, but Andrew goes on to answer his question saying, quote, "Because it is important to understand that retail investors are significantly invested in private equity. For example, public pension plans frequently invest the retirement savings of their plan beneficiaries, which include teachers, police officers, and firefighters, in private equity funds." So the point there is that folks at the commission are viewing private equity through the lens of traditional retail investor protection. I think that's an important part of the mix as well in terms of the background that I think in part explains what folks will get into in some more detail.
Great, thank you. So we're going to turn to transaction fee offsets, and we're going to have Tram walk us through that in a nutshell. What is the SEC concerned about?
Thanks, Monique. So our first case involves the use of transaction fees to offset management fees that an investment advisor would otherwise earn in connection with managing a private equity fund. This is a fairly common practice in the industry, and you know, as would be typically the case, as many of you know, in connection with making or disposing of or restructuring an investment, an investment manager would typically be entitled to earn additional fees. These fees cover such activities as engaging in due diligence, deal structuring, negotiating the terms, and monitoring the investment. So in our graph, we show on slide number 9 that the transaction fees flow from the portfolio company up to the investment advisor. We've referred to these types of fees generically as transaction fees. And over time, what investors and fund sponsors have moved towards is a practice whereby the transaction fees that are earned by the advisor are used to reduce the management fee that the advisor also earns in connection with managing the fund. So some private equity fund managers have negotiated a 100% fee offset. That means that for every dollar of transaction fees earned during the period, it reduces dollar for dollar the management fee that the advisor would otherwise earn. Other funds, depending upon the industry or the asset class, have moved towards an offset percentage of 60 to 80%, although we understand anecdotally that increasingly, as a result of increasing SEC attention in this space, that fee offsets are moving towards the 100% threshold. When you have one fund client, which is what we show on this graph, it's pretty easy or relatively straightforward to determine the offset amount that is used to reduce the management fee. In the first case that we will be discussing, we have a situation in which multiple private equity funds and co-investors advised by the same investment manager invested in the same portfolio company. As part of this particular transaction, the manager received a transaction fee of almost $4 million. However, not all investors who participated in this investment were actually entitled to a fee offset. And so the typical question that arises whenever you have multiple clients participating in an investment is, well, what is the appropriate amount that serves as the denominator? In other words, what is the amount of the transaction fee should be eligible for offset? The typical rule of thumb is that first you look to ownership, because in connection with acquiring a portfolio company, the transaction fee would be part of the acquisition price. And as a result, when you have multiple clients participating in an investment, they are sharing pro rata based upon their ownership in that investment, some pro rata percentage of the transaction fee. So as a very easy example, if I'm a 50% owner in a portfolio company, I would bear 50% implicitly of a transaction fee. And so we typically think of this approach as a pro rata allocation method, which is based upon ownership. I think it's a fairly typical practice, and if you move to slide number 10, you'll see in bolded text the language that was in dispute in this particular case. The end result and what led to this particular enforcement matter was that the SEC read this language differently from the registered investment advisor and concluded that the appropriate method for allocation is not pro rata based on ownership, but instead pro rata based solely amongst the investors who were entitled to an offset. This is a very slightly different reading of the language, and I think if you move to slide number 11, moving a little bit quickly, but I wanted to emphasize in the chart the difference on impact with respect to the management fee offset and what this really means. Under the registered advisor's approach, it earned $3.9 million in transaction fees, and using the pro rata ownership methodology, it was entitled to reduce its management fee of equivalent to $962,000. Under the SEC case, and although I confess there's no real rationale that we could discern from the order, the SEC reading would have resulted in a $2.35 million offset. So this is a very significant difference. You move from a roughly 25% offset amount to roughly 60% offset amount, which has significant ramifications for a registered investment advisor. I think we wanted to start first with a broad-based summary of the case, just to give some background to our live audience and to our webinar audience. But I wanted to give that as a background and sort of react to from a sort of conceptual perspective and also from what is present in the order for the case. Transaction fee offsets are pretty common in the private equity industry, and the question is really, what is the negotiated term? How much is negotiated between the investors and the manager with respect to the offset amount? Is it 100%? Is it 80%? Is it some other percentage? And I think that the SEC reading of this particular language poses some interesting challenges for advisors who have multiple clients, some of whom may have an offset and some of whom may not. Some of those legacy funds may have been in existence for quite some period of time, predating a lot of the SEC focus on private equity. And I think that the case really calls into question and forces all of us as practitioners who are forming new funds, negotiating some of these terms, to consider how do we interpret the language and how do we apply the plain words going forward whenever we are determining a management fee offset.
Great. Very helpful. Thanks, Tram.
Actually, before we move on, Tram, almost all the cases we're going to talk about today involve a deviation from limited partnership agreement language or language in some other representation to investors, usually in the LPA, and actual practice. Can you give us a sense in this instance, I mean, sort of chronologically, you're drafting your limited partnership agreement. I'm a litigator, so I only get involved when it doesn't go well. But you're drafting a limited partnership agreement possibly years in advance of the issue that arises later. Is this transaction fee offset, is that something that can reasonably be anticipated at the outset, or is that something that sort of evolves over time as the fund gets funded and investments start to get made?
I think that's a fair question. I think what's really difficult in the current environment is to be able to anticipate how a regulator, whether it's in an exam or an enforcement matter, can second guess or read or interpret language that's been prepared many, many years ago with a different lens. I think one running theme I see throughout many of these cases is the issue of disclosure and the difference of opinion. I think the registrant in this particular case actually took a very reasonable interpretation of the language, but the SEC in this case disagreed. So I think it's down to who wins in that debate, and I think the registrant lost. And I think that what the case really signals is an attempt for all registrants and particular practitioners to take a very hard look at language and careful drafting and trying to anticipate prospectively a lot of the types of expenses to disclose not just the types of expenses, but also the allocation methodology. So increasingly, there's a push towards heightened disclosure, greater disclosure. Mm-hmm. I think the real challenge for private equity, unlike other more liquid funds, is that private equity funds have a very long investment period. Investors are committed, they can't redeem. And so there's perhaps one of the pressures from a regulatory perspective is that investors are not in a position to challenge or disagree with a particular practice or the interpretation of a particular practice or methodology.
I thought it was interesting that in this case, so all we have to go on is the order, right? And so this is an SEC drafted document, and it's going to be sort of, it'll recite the facts in a manner that's favorable to the SEC's case. And in this case, the limited partnership agreement language that was at issue, the SEC conceded in its own order that it was ambiguous. So I found it maybe a little bit troubling that, you know, they're criticizing with the benefit of hindsight language in a limited partnership agreement that they acknowledge is ambiguous and was necessarily drafted, you know, well before mm-hmm. the issues that arise later. So it was interesting on that point.
Yeah, I mean, and just to that point, and we've heard from the SEC staff that if there's ambiguous language in the documents, it should be read in favor of the investor rather than in favor of the advisor. And so clearly that's their view in this action.
And I think one way to add to that is if you think about the starting point, I think one thing about the starting point is the disclosures or fee and expense allocations, et cetera. Another way to think about the starting point in the analysis, and you see this from what senior folks at the commission have said, is the fact that the advisor is the fiduciary. And so therefore, what are the obligations that an advisor is subject to as a fiduciary? And then things flow from that. And then to the point about if there's ambiguous language, if you have what is ambiguous language, the next question is going to be, in the face of ambiguous language, did you, the advisor, make a decision that seemed to benefit you? Or did you, the advisor, seem to make a decision that was going to benefit the LPs? And if you made a decision that was going to benefit you, that starts to sound like potentially a conflict. And then the question is what's the adequacy of your disclosures around that so that the commission can make the judgment that the LPs made an informed decision to nonetheless invest with you? And you see that in the language of some of the speeches, if not in the language of the orders, which is, well, was there informed consent? Which then comes to, as Tram said, what was the disclosure? Was the disclosure specific enough? So if you come at it, at least from my perspective, starting with what does it mean to be an advisor and your fiduciary obligation and how is the commission going to view that, then I think you have that insight and perspective on what they're doing, and whether one agrees or disagrees with the particulars, you can have an understanding as to the rationale and the perspective where the starting point is what it means to be a fiduciary as compared to the starting point being some particularities around a fee and expense.
And so just one comment on that observation. I think that's a really good point to highlight for people, which is it's not all of these cases are not necessarily per se about just fees and expense practices. It's really inherently about the potential for conflicts of interest.
Yep.
So if you look at all of these practices as being around the potential for creating a conflict, in other words, putting the needs, the interests of the advisor ahead of its clients, investors, then I think it brings a slightly different perspective to the outcome and the reading and why some of the ambiguous language that is in governing documents is read by the SEC a certain way.
Yeah, and I guess what the point that you were mentioning, are those issues and those things at red flags raising the issues of potential self-dealing, which is really that creates the big red flag and then potential, you know, enforcement and damages. So that's the red flag there.
Thank you. So we're going to turn to the closely related subject of accelerated monitoring fees in the Apollo case, and Nick will walk us through that. How is this issue different or similar to what we've been discussing?
So as a litigator and a defense litigator, I have a little different view maybe on some of these cases. This is the Apollo case. The little chart that's up there obviously looks very similar to the previous case. The money flowing from the portfolio companies to the advisor is slightly different. These are monitoring fees. So here the advisor has reached an agreement with portfolio companies that the portfolio companies will pay the advisor to monitor the portfolio companies. So the issue in the Apollo case was a term of these monitoring agreements permitted the advisor to, if there was an IPO or the portfolio company was sold, the advisor could then accelerate the receipt of those monitoring fees and get them earlier than they otherwise would have if there had not been an IPO. So that's the issue. We can go to the next slide. Here you can see, you know, large dollar amounts in all these cases. There was at the end of this, it was a settled matter. The advisor paid $40 million in disgorgement and a $12.5 million penalty. The allegation, again, these often come back to whether the disclosures to the investors, the limited partners, were adequate. And here, the monitoring agreements, this is what I just was describing, allowed the PE firm to terminate the monitoring agreements and accept the fees. So let's go to the next slide, and we'll see the language in the limited partnership agreement that the SEC found was not adequate, and here the language also appeared in some private placement memoranda that were used to solicit the investments from the limited partners into the fund. So those documents allowed the advisor to receive any consulting fees, investment banking fees, advisory fees, breakup fees, director's fees, closing fees, transaction fees, and similar fees in connection with actual or contemplated portfolio companies. So again, I have the defense litigator's perspective. That seems pretty broad to me. If we were going to defend this case, I'd say broad enough to cover accelerated monitoring fees. SEC had a different view, and obviously there are lots of reasons why these cases settle. Some reflected in the orders, some not. Advisor in this case actually disclosed the receipt of the accelerated monitoring fees. It wasn't disclosed in the limited partnership agreement because those were drafted years before any monitoring fees had been received, but the actual receipt of the fees was disclosed in a variety of ways, distribution notices, reports to the funds advisory board, and in the event a portfolio company went through an IPO, the fees were reflected in the Form S-1 filings. So you could go out and find this information. The SEC said that disclosure of the receipt of the accelerated monitoring fees was too late. It should, in the SEC's view, it should have been disclosed before the point in time when the limited partners committed capital to the fund. So in other words, as a practical matter, it should have been disclosed in the limited partnership agreement or in the private placement memoranda. I question whether that's practical. I'm not in the business of drafting these things, but the chronology, as Tron was indicating, is often that the limited partnership agreements and the PPMs are drafted perhaps years before this becomes an issue. So this is an instance in which the SEC didn't think the language was ambiguous. They thought it was, here's the language. It was just simply insufficient to cover what happened at a later date, that accelerated receipt of monitoring fees. Stefano, you look like you wanted to say something.
Yeah, for me, I guess being the forensic accountant here and probably support a lawyer in this particular case, I would also take the position, that it would be impossible at the moment that the agreement was drafted whether the accelerated fees will ever happen in the future. And this might never happen. So I found kind of hard to believe in this type of cases that they, and I would like to hear the perspective from other panelists, that this would constitute a damage or a breach of fiduciary duty or some sort of. Mm-hmm. So I would probably, look at this differently. I would probably calculate the damages starting, if there were any, from the point of time those accelerated fee were there, and then looking at are those fees being disclosed when you actually were aware of. So I think that's kind of what I would look at it, and I think that's the
good
position
point.
It should be taken.
Yeah. Another interesting aspect of this case, as in several of the cases, the SEC noted the cooperation of the advisor during the SEC's investigation. So, as you're probably aware, there is a fairly detailed cooperation program at the SEC where the SEC will give credit for cooperating during the investigation. And so it's a good thing, it's a noteworthy thing that in the order, the SEC commented on the advisor's cooperation here. And I know we had a conversation about this, Troy, before we started. You wonder what the benefit was to the advisor for cooperating when they got hit with a $12.5 million penalty. And one might, the primary elements of cooperation are self-detection, remediation, and putting in prophylactic measures to prevent it from happening in the future, plus self-reporting, which is, when you come to that day when you're deciding whether or not to self-report to the SEC, one of the things you're going to want to know is it worth it? Is the cooperation credit that I'm going to be given by the Enforcement Division going to justify the trouble that is going to ensue? I've already remediated. I've perhaps disclosed to investors, put in prophylactic measures. Should I take that next step to self-report to the SEC? Is there anything at the SEC that gives any sort of guidance about the sort of value of that cooperation?
Nick, as you're right, we were chatting about beforehand, one of the things that the regulators have said is that among those considerations, self-reporting is one that they particularly focus on, but the others are very important as well. Look, I think it could be helpful for all parties, including the Commission, if there was better understanding on the part of lawyers and market participants what kind of credit you got in exchange for what kind of cooperation. That's not to say necessarily down to the last penny, but a somewhat better sense, because as you said, Nick, a lot of folks wonder what is the credit I'm going to get in exchange for taking these steps when it comes to cooperation or remediation. And it is difficult when you see lines in an order that says, the remedy took into account the degree of cooperation and remediation to know, well, what would it have been but for that? That can be a stumbling block or at least a point of pause and hesitation. So I think it would be good for the cooperation program, the essence of which is to try to induce folks to come to the Commission, bring things to their attention, as well as to be proactive and to remediate. That actually advances the agency's goals from an enforcement perspective, but there's not much insight into exactly how much credit you get in exchange for what amount of cooperation. I will say, though, that in addition to focusing on what the financial sanction may be in any particular enforcement action, there are other ways in which cooperation of whatever particular flavor can have an impact. It might have an impact on theory of the case. It might have an impact on the charge. It might have an impact on who is charged. So there are other aspects that may not manifest themselves in an order when you simply look at the financial sanction that could have been part of the discussion around what the cooperation credit is going to look like in exchange for whatever the steps were that the defendant took.
And Nick, I just have a question about cooperation. Does that involve self-reporting in all instances, or does that involve cooperating once you've been subject to the investigation.
So in the SEC's view, cooperation equals self-reporting, I mean, among other things. If you are, if the issue comes to the SEC's attention and you've done other cooperating factors, you've identified the matter internally, you've addressed it, you've remediated somehow internally, but you failed to self-report, you're not going to get as much cooperation credit as if you self-report. It's a major factor.
There is, I guess, another component to look at it, which is basically the fear on those funds to self-report for like the public exposure. And say, okay, we had made a mistake. Let's call it a mistake when it's called self-reporting. It's like, how many years do I go back? What is the impact? So I think that there's a fear of, you know, there's that component of fear, and then and if you come forward, am I still going to get hit with the penalties? So a lot of people right now are still choosing not to come forward. So I think that's the issue of collaborating with the SEC and to find a way to, help people come forward, I think will be something very, very useful. Because I worked in a previous firm for a period of time where it was a financial services related, and in many occasions there were issues where people did not want to come forward for this particular fear itself.
If I can just add one very quick point, which is, aside from the question of what kind of credit might you get in exchange for cooperation, the fact of the matter is that you discover real compliance shortcomings. There are really are shortcomings with policies, procedures, testing, training, et cetera. Entirely aside from what credit you may get, it may simply be the right thing to do to take those steps to get your compliance program to where you think it ought to be. I don't think it's just a question of what kind of credit you get. There's a question of what do you need to have in place just to have a sound, robust, state-of-the-art compliance program.
Right, and I was thinking more in the instances where it's ambiguous and it's not a bright line and violation. We're going to hold questions till the end, if that's okay. For the audience, if you could please write questions on your card, and we'll collect them and ask them at the end. Thank you. So we're going to turn now to broken deal expenses, the KKR case. Stefano, why don't you walk us through the scenario here.
Yeah, this is actually, and again, this case goes along with the issues that we're talking about, and mostly important about the disclosure that you will have to have, as well as how you allocate those expenses. In the KKR case, what happened in this particular case is that the company did not have proper procedures. And they did not allocate expenses to the broken dealer expenses to co-investors, and they did not disclose that. And so the issue that here you have, and then what happened is that this issue came up because of an inspection. So the OCE came in, did a normal course of business investigation, and they found that there were $3.2 million of broken deal expenses that they were not appropriately allocated. So they made these adjustments, but that raised a red flag. The SEC came in, they did another investigation, and they found out there were $17.2 million of expenses that were not appropriately allocated to co-investors. Furthermore, they found out that there were no disclosure prior, basically for what we call the relevant period, which in this particular case was between 2006 and to 2011. What happened, KKR had hired a consultant in 2012 to change their policy and procedure, make a state to the art, and made this allocation proper, but they did not bother to go back and change those expenses back and allocate it properly. So not only they got hit with the $17.2 million, but they got hit with penalty, $10 million in penalty they were paid to the SEC, and another $4.5 million in prejudgment interest. So what do we learn from these lessons? I think it goes in line to what we have spoken so far. When you know you have an issue, which I assume KKR knew because they are an advisor, it probably would be, as my colleague here was saying on the panel, it would probably be good to go back and fix this problem all the way to when you know that the issue existed. Number two, probably a self-reporting would have been there, and I think it would definitely save some money without really worrying about you know, really what about the public exposure. And my suggestion is to all the people, like speaking about these cases, is exactly to do so. Hire a good lawyer, hire a good accountant, hire a good advisor, and do just that. But there's many funds that still don't do that. So I think that's what kind of we look at the issue of broker dealer expenses. Now, how does broker dealer expenses need to be allocated? It is based on the amount of committed capital, it is based on the amount of the invested capital, and also depending on the percentage of where the co-investors were eligible or are eligible to participate, under the minimum investment right. So they're not really complex things to do, but nobody does it, and they carry a big, big hefty penalty. So I think, this is a very simple case, but highlight, again, what we're trying to say: self-reporting, policy procedures, good accounting. Now, the other issue is, and I think we've been talking about, is about materiality of those expenses. When you're looking at like a company like KKR, they had $13.5 billion of committed capital, but the expenses that we're looking at were $338 million. So from another perspective, that I will not raise the issue of materiality. I know it seems a large number. So from an audit point of view, probably you will not have been able to catch this during your regular course of audit. So what do you do as an auditor? What do you do? You rely on the general fund disclosures, right? And what does a lawyer have to do and what you have to do? Those are all the questions that we need to ask. So we have an issue of materiality, we have an issue of self-reporting, we have issues of having proper policies and procedures. So,
John, can I ask a question about the this particular case? They didn't allocate any of the broker deal expenses to co-investors that were affiliated with the fund company. So what is your view on that practice?
Of not allocating?
Yeah.
Well, I think certainly going forward, if you don't allocate, it needs to be disclosed. I think that's one of the key takeaways from this particular case. I think I have maybe one question for the panel. I'm just curious to know their thoughts, and then also a question specifically for Stefano. I think in the first three, at least in the two most recent cases on broken deal expenses in particular, and in the previous case, we had a limited partner advisory committee. And in the case of private equity funds, where you have governing documents which are created well in advance of some of these issues, one potential mechanism is to use the LPAC to try to get consent, appropriate disclosure and consent for some of these practices. I don't know if the panel thinks that that may be a helpful fact in connection with the cooperation remediation discussions with the SEC. I'm curious to know. It's something I think that we've been forced to take a look at increasingly, especially as it relates to potentially conflicted transactions, regardless of whether or not it involves fees and expense practices.
Well, so a limited partner advisory committee, which a lot of funds have, is by definition made up of some of the limited partners who have invested in the fund, usually the larger ones. In my experience, those folks are so you've got a scenario where you have a potential conflict of interest or you've got a thorny issue that's come up. And so the idea would be, well, let's take it to the LPAC. They'll absolve us of any, responsibility. They'll bless what we're going to do. Limited partners, by and large, don't necessarily want to put themselves in the position of being a decision maker on these things. They're investors, so they can advise. So I think if the general partner is able to get some advice and consent from the LPAC that's helpful, I think that will help in an exam or an enforcement context. Whether your LPAC is going to want to do that and take on that responsibility is another question. So I don't see how it can hurt to get the advice from your LPAC. Certainly that's what they're there for. But we're talking about the thorniest of issues, the most difficult questions. So it's not going to be simple to get their input, I think.
And so then on a sort of related note involving auditing and insurance costs, we were recently confronted with a very similar issue where our registrant, in connection with an exam, was asked to reimburse investors. In our case, our accountants concluded that the amount of reimbursement was not material, but it would be a related party transaction subject to disclosure in the audited financials. So my question to Stefano, I don't know if you've seen this different situation arise, but one, do you think that insurance may cover some of these costs? How do you anticipate some of these considerations? Because I think increasingly people have to take a look at their insurance coverage. And then two, what's the impact on financial statement restatements, if necessary?
Well, so I think those are two answers. I actually have not seen an insurance that covers these type of issues yet. I think probably on an ongoing forward basis, there might be some sort of negotiation where, given the expansion of the SEC enforcement on those issues, some of these might be covered. So I think probably that's a good question, but I have not seen it. Personally, I have not. I don't know if any guys, any other people on the panel did that. In terms of the reissuing the financial statements, because of the issue materiality, you will not reissue the financial statements, but there will probably be a note within the financial statements that will say, they will state the issues as it was, but unless there's a material aspect to the financial statements, you will not need to restate the financial statements going backwards.
Is there some mechanism for informing investors in the fund about any restated financial statements?
I think it would be on the issue on the financial statements, and unless they want, the manager want to actually send a note to everybody else that's an issue, but I haven't seen that either. Usually it would be a note on a financial statement itself where it said that there's a restatement for X amount of dollar related to expenses.
Okay. Anything else on that?
No.
Okay. We're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about transaction-based compensation. Nick's going to walk us through the Black Street case.
Right, so we really are changing gears here because the first three cases and issues we talked about were really disclosure issues. Did the language in the limited partnership agreement, was it consistent with actual practice? So the Blackstreet case is a different animal because it's not curable. The issue that the SEC identified is not curable by disclosure. And the issue is, should the advisor be registered as a broker? So those of us in this space have probably been following this issue for years. Let me give a little bit of context first, then we'll get into the history of the issue. So in the Blackstreet case, the advisor solicited deals. We can go to the next slide. It's on there. Solicited deals, identified buyers and sellers, negotiated and structured transactions, and arranged financing and executed transactions related to portfolio companies. So you've got the portfolio companies, the funds are investing in them, but the advisor to the funds is also negotiating investments by third parties into those same portfolio companies, and the advisor's earning a fee as a result of doing these things, negotiating and identifying buyers and that sort of thing. So for the commission, the question is the private equity advisor in the business of getting compensated for engaging in securities transactions, brokering securities transactions? In the Blackstreet case, the SEC said, yes, you should have been registered as a broker or used a broker to carry out these functions. So now we'll go a little bit broader and talk about the issue. The Blackstreet case was brought in June of this year, and we go to the next slide. This issue has been bouncing around and really could use some more guidance from divisions at the SEC other than the enforcement division. I've used the term here, regulation by enforcement, maybe a little bit unfair, but that's where instead of providing helpful guidance, promulgating a rule, the way we learn about the SEC's view of the world in this context is by reading their enforcement actions, which is a tough way to go. So many of you may recall that the issue, at least in recent times, first hit the radar. And the issue is, should the private equity advisors be registered as brokers? Got on the radar back in 2013. There was an enforcement action against an outfit called Ranieri Partners. The allegations there caused a lot of people to sit up and say, well, wait a minute, we do those things too, and we're not a registered broker. That was followed up in the same year by a speech by a senior SEC person who suggested that what was ordinary course practice at private equity managers should require registration as a broker. We've had a few no action letters in the intervening years, some of which seem to give some comfort in this area. none of which are directly on point. So I've cited a couple of those. One happened in 2013, another in 2014. Then we got excited because in 2015 it looked like maybe there was going to be some movement toward some really definitive guidance specifically on topic. Most recently, the Advisory Committee on Small and Emerging Businesses Committee suggested, made a formal recommendation that the SEC take steps to clarify ambiguity in this area. That hasn't happened. The next thing that happened was the SEC's enforcement action against Black Street. So we can read the enforcement cases and we can say err on the side of caution, use a broker, be a broker. If we go to the next slide, we can see what the SEC believes, what conduct requires registration as a broker. This is taken verbatim from the SEC's FAQ on when do you register as a broker. This applies across the board. So the most critical element here is the second one. Does your compensation for participation in the transaction depend upon or is it related to the outcome or size of the transaction or deal? So there are a lot of legal precedents that one could cite to here for and against requiring registration as a broker for PE advisors. The safest thing we can say based on the Black Street cases, if you're doing those things, you better be registered as a broker or use a broker. Otherwise, the whole area could frankly use some clarification from the commission.
Does anyone else on the panel have any thoughts on this enforcement action? No? I'd just like to share some information that we had heard that OC, we've heard from different sources that OC is examining for this issue and asking people about this in their exams of private fund advisors. But we've also heard from OC staff that they actually don't have an exam module to analyze whether or not an advisor is acting as a broker-dealer and receiving transaction-based fees. So I think this area is evolving. The Division of Trading and Markets is also involved in this issue, obviously. This is their area, so there have been some folks in the SEC talking with them about this issue. We've also heard that some firms are actually not taking transaction fees anymore. They're recharacterizing or taking management fees and not taking transaction fees, so that may be a trend as well. So we'll move on. We have about 6 minutes left. We have another topic to cover, and then we wanted to get some feedback from the panelists on kind of best practices and take any questions that any of you might have. So we're going to turn it to Tram now to talk about allocating registration and compliance expenses.
Thanks, Monique. So I'll make this really quick because I think we want to give time for questions. The last case involved a situation where an investment advisor and its affiliate allocated expenses that are typically borne by the management company in connection with registering, preparing to register. It included compliance, consultant costs, legal costs, and unfortunately in this case, there wasn't disclosure about that. The disclosure in the document stated the funds would bear legal and consulting expenses of the funds, not those types of expenses that would be incurred by the management company. One notable fact, which I found very interesting, was that the case, in addition to passing on these expenses to the funds, the management companies then underwent an examination, which then led to an investigation by the SEC, and the examination and investigation costs were also being passed on to the funds without disclosure. So that was, to me, a very interesting observation, and that was cited in the order. So again, just to emphasize the importance of disclosure and in terms of impressing upon potential limited partners the types of fees and expenses that they will bear relative to the investment advisor.
Okay. So lastly, we're going to turn to each of you to give us an overview of compliance best practices. This is a really evolving area, and just from hearing from each of you, maybe impart a few words on best practices. Troy?
Sure. So without getting into the details around the fee and expense point, even though that's really been the prompt here, I think what I would say is, and Tram said this earlier, is while the cases have focused on fees and expenses, this is about more than that. And again, if anybody had any question about that, the speech of Andrew Ceresni that I made reference to a little bit ago, he explicitly talks about these cases in terms of the adequacy of disclosures around conflicts of interest more broadly. And so I'm sure everybody is going through with their clients or themselves that they're at, investment advisors, and thinking about how they stack up in terms of their practices when it comes to fees and expenses and the disclosures. But in addition to that, thinking more broadly, picking up on what Andrew said and what really is, I think, at the core of these cases, important. It's hard to say what exactly is a, quote, adequate disclosure. There's a lot of discussion around that point. I won't try to answer that question as such, but I think when you look at the way the Commission has approached this, that question is, in fact, the one that is front and center. And if you look at it, again, through this lens of what kind of information does an investor need in order to make an informed decision to invest, in order, if you will, to give informed consent to whatever the conflict, at least as it may be characterized, is, that's a different lens and a different question. And I think the one that is front and center if you read these cases and what they're getting at. So a lot of tough questions around that, very facts and circumstances specific. But I think thinking about it from that perspective will go a very long way.
So I'll continue with my different perspective. I only get involved after these things have happened. And so there's not an opportunity to redraft the limited partnership agreement when I get involved. The language is as it existed. The conduct has happened. So in a lot of these cases, each of these cases we've talked about today was a settled case, meaning what we have is the benefit of the SEC's view of the world, which is not always a correct view of the world. Sometimes parties litigate, and sometimes they prevail over the SEC. So obviously, yes, your conduct should take into consideration these cases. You should err on the side of caution and not do anything to get you anywhere near what the SEC views to be a violation. However, the rhetorical question here, how much is adequate? For several of these cases, these settled cases we've been talking about, I think the disclosure was in fact adequate. And had it been a litigated matter, I think there would be a very close call. It's very defensible conduct. So I think my parting comment would be, yes, obviously stay well clear of the line of the SEC. However, I think we're going to see some advisors choose to litigate rather than settle, and we may get some guidance from a district court judge somewhere in the country or an administrative law judge that comes out contrary to the positions that the SEC has staked out, which frankly are pretty aggressive positions.
I also get called in when the fire is already in full in full effect, and so my suggestions are several. If you are now part of an investigation, you have to be forthcoming, no shortcuts. You know, come out and be very honest with your lawyer, your accountant, make everything possible that you can, like disclosure possible, and then collaborate with SEC to the extent that is possible. And if you do think you have a case, like Nick was saying next to me, then I don't think there should be an issue trying to litigate and create new case law and limit the damage and the exposure. If you're looking from an audit consulting point of view, and you already know you have this issue, don't wait until you have the enforcement coming to your knocking your door. Start being proactive, and again, no shortcut. And you know, looking at your policy and your calculations, whether we're talking about expenses like in this particular cases or any other related issue, and look backwards to at least that where the statutory limitation brings you to it, and don't be afraid of doing so.
I think my takeaway is that increasingly investment advisors have a tremendous burden in terms of ensuring that their compliance policies and procedures are robust and can handle a lot of these conflict situations. So increasingly we have examinations. Three of the five cases we've been talking about mentioned an examination that was ongoing at the time of the investigation. So increasingly examinations are going to be a pressure point at which many of your policies and procedures will become very much the focus of the SEC. So I think that, and that's where I think the dividing line comes into play between new funds that are being launched and legacy existing funds. And I think the answer on how you approach each of those fact patterns will differ very much case by case, but increasingly with the overall general principle that it has to be read, language has to be read in favor of investors.
Yeah.
Thank you. So we're at the conclusion of our hour. We'd like to open it up to the operator to provide the New York CLE code.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like to provide the New York verification code for the CLE credit, which is 2883. Again, the New York verification code for CLE credit is 2883. Thank you.
Thank you. In the interest of time, we will try to address maybe one of these questions, Nick.
So for the benefit of the people who are live, there are about 140 people participating in the webinar. We want to stop on time. We will obviously be here afterwards. There's going to be a light lunch served. So if we don't get to some of the questions from the folks here in person, we can certainly take them up after we log off of the webinar.
Okay, great. Nick, this question is for you. Do you think that winning in front of an ALJ is possible? And what do you think of the practice by the SEC?
So ALJ, that's an administrative law judge. There's been a lot of talk lately because of the increased use of the administrative hearing process by the SEC. There's been a lot of talk about whether that's a fair process. I think, you know, the answer is, can you win in front of an ALJ? The historical evidence answers that question, yes, it happens. Perhaps not as frequently as the same case being tried in front of a jury or a district court judge. But clearly, it is possible to prevail in front of an ALJ. You don't have the right to a jury in administrative hearing. There are limits on the discovery you can conduct, and it tends to be a lot faster process than a federal district court process. We're going to see, I think, more developments in the SEC's use of administrative hearings. But a lot of these cases will go that way rather than be tried in a federal district court.
Great, thank you. So we've concluded our time here today. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for dialing in for those of you online. If we didn't get to your question, we will get back to you. For those of you here, as Nick mentioned, we'll be happy to chat with you after there's a light lunch being served. Thank you to our panelists, Troy Paredes, Stefano Veronca, Tram Nguyen, and Nick Morgan, and thank you all for attending.
Thanks, nice.
And this program has now concluded. You may now disconnect.